DW Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
Welcome to World in Progress in Bonn, Germany. I'm Anke Rasper. And in today's special edition, we've got a true story that has all the ingredients of great fiction, emperors and wars, legends and politics, greed and secrets, and even a curse. It's the story of the most famous diamond in the world, the Koh-i-Noor.
The diamond went on changing hands from one person to another king or another king emperor.
And almost everyone associated with the diamond had come to a sticky end.
Only God or a woman can wear it with impunity.
Today, the legendary Koh-i-Noor diamond is part of the crown jewels of the United Kingdom. But several countries have claimed ownership, and for decades there have been demands for the diamond to be returned to Asia. The story of the Koh-i-Noor starts in India, where it was first discovered. From there, the famous stone went on a long, checkered journey across countries and continents. Helen Cini presents this special report by Jürgen Webermann.
Koh-i-Noor, a village in the southern Indian state of Andhra Pradesh. This area, dotted with deserted settlements, is where the supposedly cursed diamond is believed to have originated. During the monsoon season, when torrential rains swell the river Krishna, everything around here is inundated. The waterline is visible on the walls of the empty houses. The people who used to live here were resettled 10 years ago, forced to make way for a huge dam project. India is hungry for electricity to continue its economic development. Even the Maoists, or communist insurgents, have left the region. In Koh-i-Noor, a concrete monument in the village centre serves as the only reminder that this community used to be in the hands of the insurgents. It's a 10-metre pillar with the communist symbols of a hammer and sickle on top. But there's some life here in Koh-i-Noor, at least now during the dry season. Gopal Rao sits next to the Maoist's monument in a simple wooden shack. In the shade, he's spread out some goods for sale. Cigarettes, a shovel, and some little lamps.
We used to do good business, selling goods to diamond hunters. But there aren't too many diamond hunters left. I have to get by with farming now.
Some bounty hunters still come here to search for precious gemstones, but it's become hard to find any, says Gopal Rao, who's in his 60s. And officially, it's actually prohibited for people to take away raw diamonds and sell them. The police officer on duty in the nearby town of Belamkonda says that his colleagues recently arrested 14 diamond hunters. Back in the deserted village, Gopal Rao smiles. Yes, the old smuggling networks are still operating, he says.
We've got our ways to sell the gemstones to northern India, to Rajasthan, Gujarat, or to Mumbai. We've got the contact numbers for traders. We call them secretly, and they come here secretly, examine the pieces, and pay.
Many years ago, Gopal's family sold a diamond for 5,000 rupees. For the farmers, it was a fortune back then. Before they learned about the true value of diamonds, they only used to receive a few rupees for the stones they found. But now people know that it's the weight, measured in carats, that determines the price. These days, many Indians, who were unable to afford them until a few years ago, are virtually obsessed with diamonds. Indian weddings are famous for their excessive display of wealth. And India plays a big role in the diamond industry globally. 90% of rough diamonds from around the world are cut in the city of Surat in northwestern India. Koh-i-Noor, however, the little village, is only famous for one gemstone, perhaps the most famous diamond in the world. Everyone in the region knows the mystical legends connected with it. Koh-i-Noor. The name comes from the Farsi language and means mountain of light. And legend has it that it was discovered right here in Koh-i-Noor.
This is the area where huge number of diamonds are surfaced mined also.
Srinivas Reddy has come along to the deserted village. He's an archaeologist and historian and also heads a private cultural centre in Andhra Pradesh. He's come to Kollur before and has been studying the history of the region. Reddy says there's no proof the Koh-i-Noor was really discovered around here. But there are many references to the diamond in stories told by travellers and traders who've come here over the centuries, including 17th century French gem merchant Jean-Baptiste Tavernier.
We do not have any inscriptional evidence, but we have literary references, chronicles, travellers' chronicles. And so Kollur is not known since the prehistoric times. It is an area where many people from faraway places used to come over here, pay huge money, used to get a lot of money through trading diamonds.
Southern India used to be famous for its gemstones. Up until the 17th century, virtually all diamonds traded worldwide came from the very region where the village of Kollur is located today. And a story about a particularly large diamond, the size of a chicken egg, has been told for centuries. Before it was cut, Koh-i-Noor would have fit that description. But there's a catch. Two other similar gemstones, also said to originate from here, fit the description as well. The lesser-known Darya-i-Noor, the Sea of Light, which today is kept in the Central Bank of Iran in Tehran. And the so-called Orlov diamond, named after the Russian Count Orlov, a lover of Empress Catherine the Great. Today it's kept in the Kremlin in Moscow. One thing the diamonds have in common is that they all once belonged to the treasury of the legendary Mughal emperors. These Muslim invaders from Central Asia came to Afghanistan and India in the 16th century and built a powerful empire. Today, significant buildings like the famous Taj Mahal bear testament to the wealth, power, the artistic skills, as well as the scientific advancements of the Mughals. Their kingdom encompassed large areas of today's India, as well as Afghanistan and Pakistan. One of the symbols of this vast empire was a throne commissioned by Shah Jahan, who also built the Taj Mahal. The throne was encrusted with more than 25,000 precious stones, including the Koh-i-Noor. When the Taj Mahal and the throne, later dubbed the Peacock Throne, were commissioned between 1600 and 1650, the Mughal Empire was at the zenith of its power.
And so they make the Peacock Throne as something completely and utterly magnificent, the most valuable furniture ever made. Cost four times the price of the Taj Mahal. It was almost invisible in the Koh-i-Noor during Mughal times because it was on the roof. The Mughals had gathered this enormous quantity of diamonds, rubies, spindles, emeralds, pearls, and gold from across India. And I mean, they love diamonds, but they prefer rubies and they prefer spindles. So when the Peacock Throne is made, the Mughal accounts mention the Great Timor Ruby, but they don't mention the Koh-i-Noor.
Scottish writer and historian William Dalrymple lives in a farmhouse on the outskirts of India's capital, New Delhi, tucked away from the hustle and bustle of the city. He's been fascinated with the emperors of South Asia for many years. His books about the fall of the Mughal Empire, about the Indian mutiny against the British East India Company, and the devastating British defeat in Afghanistan in the 19th century are bestsellers in India. The famous Koh-i-Noor diamond keeps popping up in historical documents and continues to be an object of interest for governments, courts and the media today, says Dalrymple, who's studied it extensively.
And the more I research, the less clear everything is. It's a very Indian story in that sense. What is clear is that an awful lot of rubbish and myth-making is associated with this diamond. Examining everything that's been written about this diamond and going into archives all over Afghanistan, Iran and in India, 1751 is the first time that we have a dated source reporting the Koh-i-Noor. And it's from an Iranian historian called Marvi Yazdi, who is giving an account of Nadir Shah's attack on Delhi in 1739. He reports that the Koh-i-Noor is part of the Peacock Throne.
The Mughal capital was one of the richest cities in the world at the time. More than 2 million people lived there. No European city came close to Delhi's size or power. The legendary wealth of the Mughals also attracted unwanted attention. In 1739, Persian troops launched an attack on Kabul before marching onto Delhi.
The Mughal Empire is the great megapower in South Asia. 1739, the Mughals still control all the territory between Afghanistan and the Carnatic. And Nadir Shah comes in with a very small army, only 150,000, but they have the latest in weaponry, and it's a wipeout.
The Persians, led by their emperor Nadir Shah, carried out massacres in Delhi. The city was sacked and looted. The Mughal emperor was forced to beg for mercy for himself and his people, ceding the royal treasury to the invaders.
And for a month, the Persians are sitting in the Red Fort, melting down everyone's jewellery. Everyone thinks the Brits looted South Asia. The reality is the Brits got the leftovers. But the real honeypot, the real treasure, was in Delhi. And it didn't go to Britain, it went to Persia.
And when the Persians withdrew from the city, a long convoy moved eastward to Persia, the modern-day Iran. 700 elephants, 4,000 camels, and 12,000 horses carried off all the Mughals' treasure. Nadir Shah, the victorious Persian emperor, also took the peacock throne. And he gave the huge diamond on the top of the throne its name, Koh-i-Noor. When Nadir Shah took the Mughals' treasure, he might not have been aware of the mysterious legend surrounding the Koh-i-Noor. According to Indian folklore, the diamond is cursed. The first written mention of the curse appears in a Sanskrit text dating back to 1306.
He who owns this diamond will own the world, but will also know all its misfortunes. Only God or a woman can wear it with impunity.
It didn't take long for the great conqueror Nadir Shah himself to meet with misfortune. In 1747, he fell victim to a conspiracy and was killed, decapitated in his own bedroom. And the Koh-i-Noor diamond went to a new owner, the Afghan Ahmad Khan Abdali, who had served as one of Nadir Shah's generals. He protected the emperor's harem on the night of the murder. Nadir Shah's wives gave him the diamond to thank him. Or so the Afghan version of the story goes. In Afghanistan, Ahmad Khan Abdali is also known by the name Ahmad Shah Durrani. He was elected king of the Afghan people and is still revered as father of the nation. Kabul, Afghanistan. Abdul Saber Janbash is researching the story of the Afghan king, Ahmad Shah Durrani.
With his army, Ahmad Shah Durrani advanced into the territory that is now northern India, and when he returned after several successful battles, he displayed the Koh-i-Noor in public for the first time. He wore it on his crown.
Soon after Ahmad Shah Durrani founded the Durrani Empire in Afghanistan, a mysterious tumour started eating away at his face and eventually killed him. Had the curse of the Koh-i-Noor caught up with the Afghan emperor? None of the Koh-i-Noor's subsequent owners were very happy. Ahmad Shah's son, Timur, did reign for more than 20 years, but he was probably killed by poison. The next king, Shah Zaman, one of Timur's sons, lost half the empire. Then Kabul's population rebelled against him. Just before Shah Zaman was blinded by his enemies, he managed to hide some of his most valuable treasures. He slipped the Koh-i-Noor into a crack in the wall of the fortress where he was arrested. For a long time, the famous diamond was nowhere to be found. A few years later, one of Zaman's brothers and successors, Shah Shuja, began to search for the hidden gemstone. He'd come to power 2 years after the rebellion against Zaman. a time when Afghanistan was in turmoil, gripped by tribal wars.
In Afghanistan, Shuja is both revered and hated. He's revered for his great poetry and his literary talent, but he's also hated because he made deals with the British and invited them into the country.
By that time, the British East India Company had become firmly established in India and global trade had expanded, along with Britain's influence in South Asia. The British sought to make the Afghan ruler an ally because they feared the Russian Tsars might attack Afghanistan and threaten British interests. The Great Game, the struggle over power and influence in South Asia between Russia and Great Britain, had begun. After a long search, Shuja's men eventually managed to find the Koh-i-Noor in a village where the local mullah had been using it as a paperweight. The man apparently wasn't aware of the famous diamond's history. It's not known what became of the mullah. As for Shah Shuja, he took to wearing the gemstone on a bracelet on his right upper arm. But he too met with an unlucky fate. 6 years later, he was driven from Afghanistan by opposing clans. He later returned home with an invading British army to serve as a puppet king. In 1842, Afghan insurgents defeated the British and Shuja was killed in the royal Bala Hissar Palace in Kabul. At the time of his death, Shuja no longer owned the Koh-i-Noor diamond. After the first coup against him, the Afghan king had fled to the Kingdom of Punjab, then ruled by a Maharaja named Ranjit Singh. The Punjab today is divided between Pakistan and India. The Sikhs who resided there, proud warriors and traders, offered Shuja asylum in their capital, Lahore. But the Maharaja had one condition. He wanted the Koh-i-Noor. Abdul Sabir Janbash explains.
Shah Shuja had hidden the stone under his turban and told everybody that he'd lost the diamond. But Maharaja Ranjit Singh had him searched. He then pressured Shuja to swap turbans with him as a sign of friendship.
And that's how the crafty Maharaja discovered the Koh-i-Noor's hiding place, at least according to legend. A more likely story is that Ranjit Singh tortured Shah Shuja's son until the Afghan refugee handed the diamond over. Like Shuja, the Maharaja was obsessed with the stone, and once he got his hands on it, he too wore it on his upper arm. And again, fate took its course. In 1838, Ranjit Singh died after suffering several strokes. After Ranjit Singh's death, the young Punjab kingdom was plundered during a war of succession. It was the chance the British East India Company had been waiting for, says William Dalrymple. Until that point, the British had had no control over the Punjab, and they were also after the Koh-i-Noor.
And the British write about it obsessively when it's in Ranjit Singh's hands. As soon as the opportunity comes to seize it, after the fall of the Sikh Empire, when the British fight two big wars against the British Viceroy, Lord Dalhousie, does not accept it on behalf of the East India Company, because remember, at this stage, India is not ruled by the British per se, it's ruled by a multinational company, the East India Company. It's much more sinister. It's like Google with armies or Walmart with nuclear submarines or something. And he takes the Punjab for the company, but he takes the diamond for the Queen.
In the meantime, diamond fever had taken hold in Europe. The precious stones weren't just mined in India now. They also came from colonial territories in Africa and South America. Antwerp had become the new centre of the world's trade in precious stones. And the Koh-i-Noor became a legend among diamonds. The story of the stone's curse had even spread to the elite circles of Europe's nobility by the time the Koh-i-Noor was taken to England in 1849. And fittingly, its journey was troublesome.
It goes on a ship to London and cholera breaks out on the ship, the Medea. And so bad is the cholera that the captain tries to land the ship in Mauritius. But the Mauritians won't let them land, and they shell the ship. And somehow it staggers on and arrives in Portsmouth. And almost everyone associated with the diamond had come to a sticky end. The record is not good. And one version of the story of the curse has it that it doesn't affect women. The British go with this and they put it into the Queen's crown.
Yet another male victim is still associated with the Koh-i-Noor curse, the Duke of Wellington. He had defeated Napoleon in the Battle of Waterloo. Then in 1852, the aging Duke was to oversee the craftsmen tasked with cutting the diamond. The Koh-i-Noor had been the star attraction of the World Exhibition in the British capital, London, in 1851. According to British newspapers, people of all classes lined up for miles in the rain to see the diamond on display at the Crystal Palace exhibition grounds. But the famous Koh-i-Noor looked strangely dull, unlike the other gleaming diamonds Europeans had seen before. In South Asia, size mattered more than sparkle. But in Europe, it was basically the other way around. Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, wanted to rescue the big show by cutting the stone to make the Koh-i-Noor shine. William Dalrymple smiles as he tells the story.
At the end of it, the cut is a mess because not only is the Koh-i-Noor particularly irregular, it has particularly complicated fault planes. And when you're cutting a diamond, you have to know its matrix. If you cut against them, the diamond can burn. It can catch fire. And this begins to happen. The lead case being used to hold it while it's been cut begins to melt. And they basically make a mess of it, and they lose two-thirds of the stone. So at the end, this diamond comes out. But according to my calculation, it's actually today, after this cut, the 151st biggest diamond in the world.
The Duke of Wellington died of a stroke even before the craftsmen finished cutting and polishing the stone. Now the Koh-i-Noor sparkled. But all those who had worn it before, the Mughals, Nadir Shah, the Afghan rulers and Ranjit Singh, would have been horrified about its reduced size. Queen Victoria had the now much smaller Koh-i-Noor diamond incorporated into her crown. But she only showed it off publicly after meeting the last Maharaja of Lahore, Duleep, the son of Ranjit Singh. Duleep had been just 10 years old when the British attacked the Punjab. After his abdication, Duleep lived in forced exile in England. But he was the Koh-i-Noor's last owner. Queen Victoria, maybe driven by a bad conscience, was hoping to get absolution from Duleep, and she got it. Duleep probably didn't have much of a choice in donating the Koh-i-Noor to the British crown. Just like he didn't have much of a choice when he gave it up 5 years earlier in Lahore after losing the war. Duleep Singh died at the end of the 19th century in Paris, poor and embittered. Since then, several British queens have worn the Koh-i-Noor. The last monarch to do so was the mother of the current Queen Elizabeth II, who was known as the Queen Mum. Her crown, including the Koh-i-Noor, was placed on top of her coffin when she died in 2002. Today, the crown is on display at the Tower of London. But the ghosts of Ranjit Singh, Shah Shuja, and other carriers of the diamond are more alive than ever.
Now, for the last 25 years or so.
Back in Lahore, Pakistan, and Jeffrey Iqbal is welcoming visitors at his bungalow in an affluent part of the city. Iqbal is an artist who has had exhibitions in a number of renowned institutions, including London's Tate Gallery. He's also a lawyer and is fighting a battle at the High Court in Lahore over what he considers to be Pakistan's national heritage. He wants the Koh-i-Noor back.
This diamond was taken under force coercively by East India Company. If I was Germany and I declare war on Germany, it would be called terrorism. It would be called treason. So I say those people that took the diamond from the King of Lahore, they should be prosecuted even though they may be dead for 200 years.
About a year ago, Iqbal filed a petition at Lahore's High Court. He wants the court to ask Queen Elizabeth to return the Koh-i-Noor to Pakistan. He's already been fighting for the diamond for 50 years. He's obsessed, just like the former carriers of the diamond. Iqbal estimates that he's written a total of 786 letters to the Pakistani authorities and the British Queen about the matter. The Queen answered him twice, back in the 1960s.
I received two letters in detail from the Queen. That was in the 60s. But now, probably the correspondence to which she is exposed has become so huge, she no longer personally takes interest.
The Queen hasn't said anything about his request to return the precious stone, and his petition at the High Court isn't getting anywhere either. Jeffrey Iqbal isn't the only one demanding that the diamond be returned to its origins. Even the Afghan Taliban made claims for the diamond in London during their rule in the 1990s. They see themselves as part of the tradition of Ahmad Shah Durrani, the founder of the modern state of Afghanistan and a previous owner of the Koh-i-Noor. But since the Taliban were overthrown in 2001, the Afghan government in Kabul has been less vocal about the diamond's return. Abdul Sabir Janbash from the Afghan Academy of Sciences doesn't think returning the diamond to Afghanistan is the right move.
The Taliban only wanted to dazzle people and show them how powerful they were, that they could force the return of the Koh-i-Noor. But Afghanistan has lost much more substantial treasures to invaders. I believe the diamond belongs to India. After all, that's where it was found.
Well, those who believe the Kohinoor should be returned, Rakesh Sinha, Professor...
It's hard to believe the Kohinoor diamond has become not just a prominent subject of discussion, but also of potential controversy.
New Delhi. The debate over the Kohinoor is still loudest in India. Should the government ask for the diamond to be returned or not? India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, did exactly that after India's independence 70 years ago. But his request and several others over the ensuing years have been unsuccessful. The Indian government stated in 2016 that the Koh-i-Noor is India's property. But no one really believes that Great Britain will give back the legendary diamond, which for many in South Asia has become a symbol of British colonialism and the looting of their countries. Kollur, Andhra Pradesh, the ghost town where the legendary story of the Koh-i-Noor once began, we'll see the return of diamond hunters after the summer monsoon season, when the Krishna River has retreated to its riverbed. That's when they hope to find more diamonds in the sediment left behind. Srinivas Reddy, the archaeologist, thinks the Koh-i-Noor belongs to South India. Maybe not to Kollur, but at least to the state of Andhra Pradesh.
The best claim is the Andhra Pradesh state, because it hails from this area. The diamond was mined from Kollur, which is in the state of Andhra Pradesh. Though it went on changing hands from one person to another king or another king emperor from 1300 AD down to 19th century. Not only me, the entire whole of the state will be very much delighted if we definitely get it.
Andhra Pradesh will soon get a new museum, and Reddy wants the Koh-i-Noor to be featured as part of the history of this region. Even if the original stone doesn't make its way back to India, he believes the museum should at least pay tribute to the adventurous story of the most famous diamond in the world.
You are listening to the story of the Koh-i-Noor Diamond in a special edition of World in Progress. Helen Sini presented the report by author Jürgen Webermann. To listen back to this program and other editions of the show, go to dw.com/worldinprogress or download the podcast from iTunes or SoundCloud. And we'll have a fresh show for you next week. My name is Anke Rasper, and this was World in Progress from DW in Bonn, Germany. Thanks for tuning in and take care.